We'll go ahead and call the Commerce Committee to order. We don't have a quorum right now, but we can go ahead and start with some testimony. We won't be able to take any official action on anything until we have a quorum. First up on our agenda today, we have House File 2235, and we have Representative Sertich here to present that. So why don't you, if you want to go ahead and move your own bill, I think you have an author's amendment. Did you want to do that right away?
Since we don't have a quorum,
I'm sorry, Chair. You got to wait. So, yes.
I won't move anything yet, but we'll get to discussing a very thick bill, House File 2235, which is actually a housekeeping technical change and some smaller changes to the unemployment insurance statutes. I sit along with Representative Gunther, members of the business community, labor community, thankfully some lawyers and some business folks on the Unemployment Insurance Advisory Council. I spoke long enough to get my experts to the table, so I feel much more secure now. I feel like Linus and my blanket has arrived. A lot of this is housekeeping and technical changes. There are some substantive changes in the bill that we'll draw your attention to. And if I lie or mess anything up, these two will jab me in the ribs and we'll get to talking. We can't. We don't form yet. So if we first look to Section 10 of the bill, or the summary, which is much easier to read, if you have that with you, it eliminates the mandatory and becomes optional unemployment insurance coverage for corporate officers who own 25% or more of the employer corporation. Section 11 clarifies the definition of suitable employment. From what has been told to me, as far as paying unemployment insurance, suitable employment is kind of vague, and they want to keep it vague. Some people think that change of suitable employment, if you're the CEO of the company and you get moved to janitor, that would be a change of employment that would cause you to leave your company. So somewhat technical change there. Moving along to Section 25, I'm skipping some of these. A lot of it really streamlines and allows for employers to electronically file unemployment insurance. Section 25 deals right to the heart of that. This requires large employees of 500 or more to pay their unemployment taxes electronically. I've spoken to the agency and to these gentlemen, and they said, of course, they're gonna help folks that maybe you can't do this right now. They're not going to turn away a $200,000 check from a company, but they're encouraging to streamline, and this is actually what we heard from businesses, that to put things online is the better way to go. Moving along here through some of the other sections, call your attention to Section 63, which is the clarification that I was talking about earlier. Section 71 deals with the commissioner's representative overlooking some of these UI claims. Before they go to court, they're handled in-house. And sometimes an employer or employee will disagree with the action and send it to a senior unemployment review judge. This basically says that if an employer or employee just appeals the decision on the grounds that they didn't like the decision, that is not an option. A lot of times people just say, I didn't like the claim. They don't have any new information. They don't dispute any of the facts. They just appeal for appeal's sake. And this gets rid of that appeal. I'm sure my lawyer friends appreciate that. Once again, I'm going to mention at this point that all sides basically signed off on this, labor, business, and the folks on the committee. There's one more section, Section 86, that we have a very expert witness to come in and talk about in a moment. But before we do that, I'd like to open it up for any questions to the experts on both sides of me.
Okay, before we do that, Representative Sertich, we do have a quorum present, so I will officially call the meeting to order. And if you want to now, you may go ahead and move your bill.
Sure. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 2235 to pass and doesn't have to be sent to the floor. General Register.
Okay, Representative Sertich moves House File 2235, recommended to be passed and sent to the General Register. Okay, with that, did you want to do your amendment now?
Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay, go ahead and explain your amendment.
Okay, I actually have two amendments. One is going to be oral and very brief. Is it in the amendment? Okay, never mind then. One is we're just down to one amendment here, and it's being passed around right now. what happens is it's a two-part amendment. When you're collecting this application, this data online, a little box will appear. A lot of employers have processing agents, and a little box will pop up, and this is just to help streamline the information and figure out who to contact if there is any trouble. And it puts it so that a person would have to put in their processing agent's address to help the folks at Deed figure that out. The second part of it is a little more interesting. There was a term that was passed in the bill dealing with UI back in 2003 that contains the term evinces, and that is found nowhere else in statutes. The revisor of statutes would like it if we use the word that is a little more readily used in our language. Evinces actually does mean, in Webster's dictionary, it's defined as to constitute outward evidence or to display clearly. Another word for it is demonstrates, and I think a lot of us around the table and in the audience, Mr. Chair, knows the word demonstrates better, so it would ask to change evinces, which is only used once in the entire set of statutes that's behind you, to demonstrates. So that is the thrust of the amendment, the two-part amendment. And I would like to move that right now, the A04-0911 amendment.
Okay, Representative Sertich has evinced us that this is a good amendment. Evinced to us that the Representative Sertich moves the A04-0911 author's amendment. Without objection, I'll say, because it's an author's amendment. So without objection, the author's amendment is approved.
Can I ask him to spell that without looking at it?
E-V-I-N-C-E. Oh, him.
Okay. What the chair said.
Yeah. Okay, we have before us, we have House File 2235 as amended. Representative Sertich.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to open it up for questions.
Questions. Any questions? Representative Pugh.
May as well ask one, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and Representative Sertich, or perhaps your colleagues there, Section 63 changes reasons for quitting that might be attributed to the employer. You can, as my understanding of current law, obtain uninsurance benefits for unemployment even if you quit the job, if you, there's some conduct by the employer that caused you to leave. Are the changes made in this section significant to current law, and if so, how are they significant?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, I'll take a first stab at it, and then I'll pass it along here. What is happening right now is we'd like to leave it with this language in the case where the judge can decide. I spoke about this a little bit briefly at the beginning. People have different reasons for leaving jobs, whether it be financial or other substantial reasons. As I spoke of before, you could go from being the CEO to being the janitor, still paid the same, but that, I think, would be good grounds to leave the job. That is not pay permitted. So I think a judge would be able to look at this on a case-by-case basis and decide if that reason is rational and substantive or not. But I'll also have you go ahead and take a stab at it, too.
Mr. Chair, I am Dee Nelson. I am an attorney with the Department of Employment and Economic Development. Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, what we're trying to do here is make it clear that we look at each case on its own individual basis, rather than saying, for example, a demotion without a cut in pay is not a good reason caused by the employer for quitting. There actually is a case out there which says that. But the problem is, if you're moved from president to the janitor, I'd say that's a pretty good reason to quit. What we're always trying to do is say here, and we look at each case. There is nothing as a matter of law that one is one way or the other. We're going to look at each case, look at the individual facts, and decide would an average reasonable person quit under those circumstances. So there's nothing written as a matter of law that either would be one way or the other. We'll look at each case individually.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Pugh.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Nelson, except in the case of sexual harassment, that standing alone would be sufficient. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, Representative Pugh, that is in current law, so we didn't want to remove the sexual harassment provisions. So we're just saying current law is existing, current statutory provision. We don't want to change the statute.
Thank you.
Representative Goodwin.
Along that same line, thank you, Mr. Chair. Is any other human rights issues that would not be protected with that? Would not necessarily be overall protected with that new language?
Mr. Chair, Representative. Well, I think we're asking that we look at, you know, each case individually. Would an average reasonable person quit under these circumstances? And what we're saying is we don't want the courts, and it has ruled certain ways. And another example, and I'll get to that, your specific one, is a cut in pay. There has been a couple of rulings that are 15% cut in pay, something less than 15% is not a good reason caused by the employer for quitting as a matter of law. But the problem with that is if you're only paid $7 an hour, a 15% cut is huge. But if you're paid hundreds of thousands of dollars, a 15% cut isn't so huge. We're saying we should look at each case individually. Now, as to human rights violations, we have to look at the specific individual. We don't want to say, if this happens, therefore you're entitled to benefits if you quit. How did it affect you as an individual? If it adversely affected you as an individual, if you as an individual, the average reason the person would quit, then you're entitled to benefits.
Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Representative Goodwin, my intent of this language is to broaden it out to make sure that more people are covered on this issue and not to limit the reasoning, but to broaden it out. And I think going by case does not allow some laws to set certain precedents to hinder other employees from collecting this or workers from collecting unemployment insurance.
Okay.
Well,
Representative Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'd like Mr. Pender to respond to that and ask him if this is going to change the standard and affect any negatively, if this has a potential to negatively impact any human rights cases.
Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair and Representative Goodwin, I think this probably cuts both ways in terms of whether something is a matter of law, either now for either before this change, for instance, whether something is a matter of law would be considered good cause to quit, and there may be other things that are now considered as a matter of law to be not good cause to quit that this change would open up the possibility of considering. So as far as I know, it would have the possibility of cutting both ways, the general principle being that it looks at the individual situation and not just automatically assuming that a particular thing, once you've proven it, justifies or doesn't justify quitting.
Would it
continue?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would it then increase the burden of proof on the employee?
Does this fix that?
Mr. Pender.
Mr. Chair and Representative Goodwin, it certainly could in some situations, because if something is not good cause to quit as a matter of law, then you have to go beyond just proving that situation exists, but have to prove your own particular situation and how it affects you and whether it's a good cause for you to quit, while it might not be a good cause for someone else to quit. So it could increase the amount of evidence a person would have to produce. On the other hand, if you're trying to get a determination that you had a good reason to quit in something that would otherwise not be as a matter of law, this would give you a chance to, by producing that extra evidence, to have things go the other way. So it does involve more evidence, which could be good or bad for the person who's appealing the decision.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Pender.
Ms. Wilson, did you need to add something, or I think we're taken care of? Okay. Representative Wilkin had a question.
I got the answer.
You got the answer. Okay. Further questions? Any further questions?
Mr. Chair, I have one more person to come up to testify on the bill for
okay.
another section. My expert witness.
You want to leave well enough alone and
I cannot
mess this up here now.
I cannot, Mr. Chair, and there's a very good reason why.
Oh, okay.
Section 86 deals with some legislative intent from last year, and I have somebody who might be familiar. It's most of the committee, Linda Holmes, who's actually for once in this committee taking sides on an issue, which is interesting to see her on this side of the table. So be nice to her, and I'll let her testify.
Welcome back to the committee, Ms. Holmes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Linda Holmes. I'm an attorney in the Unemployment Insurance Legal Affairs Division at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And what I was asked to talk a little bit about today is this particular last section. This is section 86 on page 88, talking about the legislative intent, specifically with regard to the effective date of a change to the definition of misconduct. And as the bill was passed last year, it's essentially, I think there's some ambiguity as to how the department was to imply it. It was to apply it as far as when to start applying it. Probably it should have had a clearer effective date at the time it was passed, but since that did not occur, mistakes for me. The department essentially was in the position of...
Mr. Chair, who's making faces at her?
I see that. Do you want to say something to this point right now?
Yeah, well, I can do it right now. I just wanted to find out if there was somebody that might have been to blame for that. No, I guess maybe I don't want to know.
Mr. Chair, to that point,
blame here.
Well, and if we're looking at blame, we're all big people with election certificates, so I would think that the legislators that actually put their names on the bill would take blame in these issues and not staff. And I would think that most legislators around the table would agree with me on that.
I think we'll agree with that.
You're right.
Shame on you.
I was trying to get the story here.
Ms. Holmes, go ahead, continue.
Mr. Chair, members, it's my fault. I opened it up. essentially, it was a little ambiguous as to how they were to apply it. So the department interpreted it to apply to determinations, adjudications, and things like that that the department made after the effective date of the new language. And I think that's the right interpretation. I think that's the best interpretation that they could have made given the language that was in the bill. And that is, in fact, the way it was applied. So, in fact, my understanding is there are probably 20,000 or so determinations that have already been made under the new language since August 1st. And I also want to stress, in the vast, vast majority of cases, it does not make any difference which of these two definitions you apply, the old one or the new one. It does not matter in the vast majority of cases. It's more that the new definition is a lot clearer. It usually gets you to the same result, but through a less difficult subjective analysis. So there are very few cases where it makes any difference. But the department was, in fact, put in the position of it has to apply one definition or the other. And the decision that was made was on and after August 1st, when they look at an employee in terms of eligibility, because it's an adjudication of your current status as eligible or not eligible, that they would just say that the date of the adjudication or the determination that they were making was when they would start applying the new language. It doesn't make a lot of sense to use some of the other things you might think in terms of when was the conduct. You can't really use the conduct because the conduct often takes place over a period of sometimes, I mean, I've worked on cases where the conduct took place over a period of years, and you can't really go back and say the conduct you did before this date, the law was this at that time, so therefore this much was conduct that we would count and this we wouldn't count. It creates very, very difficult to administer situations if it's done that way. So this is the interpretation they made. I think it's the right interpretation. It's the interpretation I would have recommended at the time. This is what they did. They've already done it. So I think by far the easiest and best way to resolve the ambiguity is to go ahead and adopt the interpretation that the department made at the time so that it will be clear. And as I said, it's not going to deny a bunch of people, grant a bunch of people benefits. The vast majority of times doesn't make any difference. It's just purely they have to know which to apply, and they had to apply one or the other. So that's my testimony.
Thank you, Ms. Holmes. Any questions? Seeing none. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Goodwin and Representative Clark.
Okay, I'm still a little confused about the language we just spoke about, because when I read it in the bill on page 64, unless there's the amendment changes somehow that I don't see, it still looks to me like it would be a much better chance for an employee to not be allowed unemployment for reasons that they would have been allowed unemployment in the past. I guess I would like to know if how important this section is to you, Representative, and if you would be willing to take that out.
Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members, and Representative Goodwin. I don't know if you were at the beginning of the conversation, how this bill becomes determined. There's an unemployment insurance advisory task force.
I know that.
This language was agreed upon by labor and business legislators from both bodies, both sides of the aisle. So I'm carrying it forward as a agreement by all these bodies.
Why?
Does that satisfy you, Representative Goodwin?
No, because I can't believe labor agreed to this, quite frankly. But I'd like to hear from labor if they're here on this provision. Is there anybody from labor here that's on that?
Is there anybody from the Department of Labor or an industry here?
Labor.
Real labor. Come on down from real labor. Or can Mr. Nelson answer?
Well, he wants another step.
Mr. Chair, oh. Representative Goodwin, this will not result in more people denied unemployment. I agree with Mr. Pender that there might be a few people who would be, there are going to be just as many who are now denied who are going to collect. We do not believe that this will result in more people denied benefits. It allows for an easier application because you look at the individual circumstance. You look at what an average reasonable person quit. And everyone gets the same standard as opposed to some of these. If it's a demotion but no cut in pay, well, then you're automatically out. And there are a few of those out there in case law. And we say that if there are some things which the legislature believes that that's all that, if that occurs, you will collect regardless of the actual impact on you, then it should be, in fact, in the statute. We would like the statute to cover the public policy of when an individual collects benefits. Everything should be right in the statute. And we're simply saying if an average reasonable person would quit, then in those circumstances, they collect benefits.
Okay, Representative Goodwin.
What bothers me about that is the change says that resulted in a favorable impact on the worker. Who makes that determination and how?
Mr. Nelson.
How do you judge that?
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's interesting. We've had a couple of cases, I won't mention the employer, who actually gave such a good buyout. He gave a couple of years of severance if you would be willing to quit. And if you looked at the definition without that, you could say, if you look at good reason caused by the employer, it says, for which the employer is responsible, which would cause an average reasonable person to quit. And the argument was, I had a good reason to quit because the employer made it so favorable to me that I want to leave. And we're saying, okay, if there's any impact on you, it can't be favorable. It has to be adverse. And that's what gives you good reason to quit. They can't make it so attractive that an average reasonable person quit, and then you can collect unemployment benefits, too.
Okay, Representative Sertich.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Goodwin. My intent in this language is to make it more broad. My intent is so that there's not a case out there where somebody gets demoted, and then there's a judgment on that, and then we have to use that as the judgment forever with every employee that's ever been demoted from, you know, X position to Y position. I don't want that to set the precedent for every decision that those folks won't collect benefits. I'd rather it be that a judge has to look at it case by case, every demotion, and say, this demotion is different. They are allowed to collect benefits.
Representative Goodwin.
Representative Sertich, I do not doubt at one bit your reasons for what you think is going to happen out of this. I am concerned about people, and there's a lot of them right now, that are being laid off in the example that was used here on the severance pay and so forth. This would also give them the right to deny unemployment benefits if they did get a severance package of any kind. I mean, somebody's going to be throwing those determinations out there, and we've got people right now that are being forced to train their replacements from other countries, and then they know they're going to lose their job in 6 months. Anyway, so they have to stay to train their replacement worker for 6 months because otherwise they're being threatened to lose their severance package. Well, now those people not only are losing their jobs, training somebody else for their jobs, but then they could, under this, be denied unemployment, and I am concerned about that.
Mr. Nelson.
Chair, Representative Goodwin. In a specific situation, this was strictly a voluntary decision on the part of these workers at a rather large Eastern Metro employer who were making, and these were high-paid people, we were talking scientists and all the rest of this, that they wanted, they were offering these tremendous severance packages to. If it's forced upon someone, that's not a quit. This, none of this comes into play unless you, the worker, makes the decision to leave. If the worker is being laid off, this whole clause doesn't apply. It only applies to those people who quit. The law provides for 8 exceptions. You're denied benefits unless you fall under one of the 8 exceptions to quitting. And this is one of the 8 exceptions, a good reason caused by the employer. And all we're doing is defining it here and making it very clear that we look at the individual circumstance rather than some just... Representative Surge made just some blanket thing that may have happened. How did it affect the individual worker?
Okay. Representative Clark, you had a question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. It was kind of along the same line, and Representative Surge, you're one of the strongest fighters for what this area, so I think again, it's a huge question on you. But I guess I did have a question too about so who decides? I guess it's the judicial person in the system that's making that decision. But what if on line 11 it says resulted in a favorable impact on the worker? What if, and I'm thinking of nurses and others who are forced sometimes to work overtime hours or there are other types of things like that. There's a favorable impact of getting more money, you know, but the unfavorable impact is that the working situation is dangerous for patients and others. And that's just one example. I'm just thinking there might be cases where you get, yes, there's a favorable impact monetarily or something, but since it says, I mean, I wonder if you don't, Can any favorable impact throw the book out then if there's some negative impact, or is it going to be a judgment? If it's when you're allowing the judgment, does it take away the judgment at all?
Well, Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I'll take the first stab at this. It's my intention that no, I think my intention is to include the judgment back in here. I think without this language, a judge could look at it and say, because you're paid the same amount of money as you were paid before, we're going to not allow you to collect benefits. Now, with saying favorable judgment, I believe that a worker can make the case, sure, I have the same amount of money, but I'm endangered in my workplace. Or like I said earlier, I used to be the president and now I'm the janitor. I was not impacted favorably, and it has more to do maybe with not monetary issues, but other issues, such as what you're talking about, what I'm talking about.
Okay, Representative Gunther. I'm sorry. Representative Clark, for that follow-up.
I think the thing was not that we have the same. It could be something. So there would be something positive you could say. It has something favorable. But the overall may be favorable. So that's like a question that I don't know.
Mr. Nelson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I think you have to go back to paragraph A of the provision. Would an average reasonable worker quit in that circumstance? That's the test. If an individual is being required to work so many hours, an average reasonable person would quit under that circumstance regardless of the pay, then they would be entitled. But we don't put any bright lines to say if you're required to work 5 hours of overtime, it means this, or less than 5 hours, it means that. We're saying, what would the average reasonable person do taking all the facts and circumstances of that individual case? But all we're asking here is to look at the individual case and make an individual judgment. In certain situations, yes. In certain situations, not.
I'll end this.
Representative Clark.
With a comment. This was a strike issue. An average reasonable people who ran the company would be on one side, and average reasonable people who were walking the picket line and doing the work every day were on another side. So who's the average reasonable standard? That's, I just think there's a question that this raises, and I'll leave it at that.
Okay, Representative Gunther.
I just have a point of clarification since Representative Clark is a nurse. I thought a couple of years ago we made it so they could not punish nurses that didn't want to have take overtime. Isn't that correct?
I believe in the end it was a voluntary
thing that I've acquired. I know I co-opted that. Yeah, we tried to get it. I didn't think it was very reasonable at forcing people to work in overtime.
That's an example. I mean, that's quite a few years worth of, a lot of people suffered to get a little bit of privacy made on that.
Okay, any further questions on the bill? Seeing none, Representative Sirch renews his motion that House File 2235 as amended be passed and sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? And the bill is passed. Thank you very much,
members.
Next item, Representative Simpson. Welcome to the committee, Representative Simpson. I'll go ahead and move your bill for you. So I will move House File 2071. Representative Simpson, tell us about your bill. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First of all, I would like to make a verbal amendment, please.
Okay.
And that would be on page 2, line 18. The word is commission. I'd like to change that to commissioner. Just change the last two letters.
Commissioner.
O-R.
Okay. Representative Simpson has an author's oral amendment to his bill on page 2, line 18. The word commission, add letters E-R. Commissioner. Okay, with it's an author's amendment, so without objection, that is part of the bill. Go ahead and explain your bill.
Okay, thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to present House File 2071, which will reenact the employment agency provision of a bill from the 2001-2002 session loosening regulations on search firms. In that bill, when language about search firms was deleted, the exemption for search firms was accidentally deleted along with it. The bill reinstates the exemption that search firms were meant to have in Section 184-22. I have the definitions of search firms and employment agencies here. I would say a search firm operates more in a management consultant role or a personal consulting, while an employment agency procures employees for employers for compensation or hire. I'd like to point out this bill keeps checks on the search firms, and if they cross into doing work in an employment agency, the Department of Labor will still have to be able to investigate. Unnecessary regulations can hinder job creation in Minnesota and freeing employers from such regulations, while still maintaining oversight, which is reasonable, will benefit all Minnesotans. This is, members, a very reasonable bill, bringing it up to date in the code that the legislative intent expressed in 2001 and 2002. And I believe Representative Gunther carried this bill in that session, and this was omitted in the final version. So that's what it's about.
Okay. We have Representative Stang, and then Mullery.
Representative Simpson, in the last bill, we looked at putting blame on somebody for the mistake. So are you saying that this was Representative Gunther's fault that we're back again today? Or?
You're allowed to blame members.
Representative Stang, as one grocer to another grocer, we don't ever blame each other. Good bananas all the time.
Representative Mulry.
Mr. Chairman, I just wondered how much time of the legislature has to be put in correcting Representative Gunther's screw-ups.
You notice he's not on, Mueller's not on jobs any longer.
That's a rhetorical question.
Oh, okay. Actually, what I want to do is point out to everybody in the committee here that we've got a group of students with us. We've got ninth grade students from St. Louis Park High School. So give a wave. Welcome to the House Commerce Committee. And hope you're learning a lot from democracy in action today. So welcome.
Who to place blame on?
Yes. Okay, do we have any questions for Representative Simpson on this bill? I see none. Then I will renew my motion that House File 2071 be passed as amended and sent to the General Register. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
And opposed? The motion carries and the bill is passed. Thank you, Representative Simpson. The next item on the agenda is my bill. Oh, we need to do the minutes first. Okay. If everybody could please take a look at your minutes from Tuesday, February 24th. And Representative Mullery moves the minutes be approved. Any, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
And the minutes are approved. Any other items of business I missed? Okay. With that, I'm going to turn the committee over to Chairman Lindner. We'll do the last item of business on the agenda. Oh, I'm sorry, not the last item. We have another item on the agenda after this. The last bill on the agenda.
Okay, while Representative Gerlach is taking his position up at the witness table, presenter's table, we've got a number of people that's interested in this bill here. We have proponents and opponents of this particular bill, and quite a few. So we want to be fair in this presentation. So after Representative Gerlach presents his bill, we'll have 15 minutes for the proponents and 15 minutes for the opponents in their testimony, and you can work that out among yourselves. One person can talk 15 minutes, or 20 people can talk whatever that would come out to be. So we'll let you decide that. Welcome to your committee, Representative Gerlach. You'd like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to move my bill, House File 2227. I'd like it recommend or move to have it passed to the House floor, to the General Register.
Okay, Representative Gerlach, I see you have a delete all amendment. Would you like to move that now?
I do, Mr. Chairman. I actually have a delete the DE1 and then also another amendment to that. So we'll take it slow here, make sure everybody understands exactly what we're doing. I would like to move the DE1 amendment at this time as an author's amendment.
Okay, members, you have the DE1 amendment before you, the delete all amendment. Any questions about that? It's an author's amendment. Okay, we'll accept that.
Okay, thank you. And then, members, I have we had a meeting with the interested parties yesterday and came up with some additional compromises and resolutions, and we have incorporated many of those into the A1 amendment, which is a line or page and line amendment. That would be the A1 amendment. I'd also like that to be an author's amendment as well. And I'll be able to speak to the bill in its entirety.
Okay, members, we'll just hold questions then. Let the Representative Gerlach present his bill, and then we can be able to address the whole thing at once. So
does everybody have a copy of the A1 amendment?
Mm-hmm. Okay, so okay, Representative Gerlach has moved the A1 amendment. Any objections? If not, we'll accept that as the as an author's amendment. Okay, hold up on that, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gerlach, on your A1 amendment, in line 10, where you're talking page 3, line 11, after services, insert divided by number of licensed home sites. Explain where that came from. Is there some problem? There unlicensed home sites in some of these parks? Or
yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, the actual change of the whole thing comes from a mathematical error that corrects, sort of a technical correction. The fact that, your point of your question, what does licensed mean? I don't know. So can we just put that on? I could explain, or do you want to know now, or we can always take it off if it doesn't fit? Do you want to do that? Take care of that now?
We could do one of the 15 minutes. Somebody will explain it to me.
Okay, maybe it will. All right. So we'll make a note of answering your question then.
Okay, again, we're accepting the author's A1 amendment to his delete all DE1.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. And members, what I wanted to do now that you have the bill in front of you is explain as we go through what this is all about.
This bill or this issue was brought to me by the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association. This is an association of manufactured home parks, the owners, and obviously they have many residents, and this issue is...
You heard a lot of crying in here.
Yeah. Well, there have been a lot of court cases dealing with issues between park owners and residents. This is one particular issue having to do with water billing, the utility of water billing and metering and how that's done. And there's been a mixed bag of court rulings. There have been some courts, depending on how the park implemented water metering, some courts have said that you have done this incorrectly, unreasonably, therefore you can't do it. Some others have been, you know, okay, or it's been a mixed bag. The courts do not have full clarity on this issue, and so what we're trying to do here with this bill is set up a system of rules whereby if a park owner chooses to go forth with metering water usage by residents, that there are serious hurdles and there are serious checks and balances, and that there are protections for the residents. The goal of this is not to enrich park owners to become profit centers on water utilities, but rather that if this is going to happen, to give clarity to the courts and find a fair solution in doing this. That is the attempt. So this establishes that fair set of rules for resident protections. This does not legislatively overturn decisions. The case you may hear about in testimony has to deal with a property owner, Bethel Properties, which managed Castle Towers. That was an egregious example whereby a park owner implemented water metering and just added it right on top of the residents and says, you will now pay for this. And that was challenged in court, and the residents said, you can't do that. We have a lease that says it's included. You can't do that. Current statute says that you cannot substantially modify rules. There are exceptions. Things have to be within proper parameters. And you can't. You cannot do that. And the court ruled in favor of the residents. It went to an appellate court, which is when the court decision was upheld. That was the correct decision. The courts did the right thing. So now we have a problem of how do we do this? We know we can't do it that way. What do we do so that the residents don't end up getting shafted when you're dealing with this water utility issue? So what I want to do is explain to you through the bill here very briefly what some of these provisions are all about. If you could look at the first section, line 5, on the delete everything, begins by defining what a measuring device is, the meter. The very first issue that comes up in the bill, not necessarily the larger issue as far as impact, but the first one on the bill, has to do with line 8, where we're talking about how often you're billed. We can't have park owners stack up water bills and all of a sudden, once a year, go and lay it on a resident and say, you owe us for a year's worth of water. That would be unreasonable, that would be unfair, and not helpful to anyone. So we are specifying in statute that billing has to be done essentially timely, either monthly or quarterly. A lot of cities do quarterly billing, some do monthly, it's different, but it can't be beyond quarterly. You can't let them stack up. That is a something that I told the park owners has to be in the bill before I'm going to continue to carry it, because it has to have a reasonable protection for residents. The next issue is, what about the meters themselves? How do we know what these meters are going to be? So what we have is we have standards here, and the amendment spells out those acronyms, that a meter has to meet these nationally recognized certified standards that you have in here. The next item is line 12 in the delete everything, talks about installation. The issue is, well, how do you know who's installing these things? How do you know that they're qualified? How do you know that they're going to do it accurately? And if I do turn around a bit, I guess I'm speaking to the audience as much as I am speaking to the committee, because I want a full understanding of what this bill is about. And I think that's absolutely important. So please follow me through these protections that I think are very important. So we have in line here, on line 12, that you got to follow the manufacturer's instructions or the Minnesota Plumbing Code. It has to be installed correctly. Also, how do you verify this? How does a resident know if the amount that they're told they have to pay is accurate?
Well, in line 14, that display has to be readily accessible to the resident for inspection, so a resident can look at that meter and know. It's not in law now. Those are some of the protections for residents in that first paragraph. If you would, turn the page, please, on page 2, subdivision, the additional language at the front is just simply allows for this to happen, that this is a, if you follow all these rules, that you can do this. Subdivision 5 on line 29 of page 2, if they go ahead and do install these meters, line 33, the park owner may not directly bill the residents for the cost and installation of the measuring devices. They're not cheap, but you can't turn around and say, well, by the way, here's X dollars for the cost of this meter that we just put on. You can't do that. That would be unreasonable and unfair. Line 34 continues. Each billing statement, here was an issue that I told the park owners to put in because I had people tell me that all I'm getting is a piece of paper that says you owe X dollars. That's probably been some experiences here. That is unreasonable and unfair because how do you know? How does a resident know how many gallons they're being charged for? How do they know what rate it is? Where are the checks and balances? So what I put in here is each billing statement shall contain the actual usage amount. How many gallons did you use for the billing period and the rate charged to the resident? So you know exactly what you're being billed for. And that's critical to making this fair. On the next page, you'll see that the rate has to be set. Let's see here. That the owner can only consider the amount that was billed by the third party. Third party meaning city water. If the city is pumping it into the park and it's going to the residents, a park owner cannot turn around and overcharge the residents. Line 3: a park owner shall not consider administrative, capital, or other expenses. You can't charge for reading the meters. Those sorts of protections are in there. So you don't get dinged on those sorts of things. Line 4, if the water sewer service is provided by means of a private well, then we have the same thing in here, protection about the rates, because we already have law about utility rates in subdivision 3, that if you look in the statute is there. We have those safeguards. So what happens, the court case in Castle Towers was that they just tacked it on the rent. We have in here, originally, we put that we gave park owners a choice. You either forego future rent or roll back rent. After discussions from yesterday, and it's in the A1 amendment, we decided that, you know what, rather than putting that off into the future, let's have a rent reduction right now. So it's dollar for, you know, or, you know, it's an offset. So your rent is reduced. That is where, that the critical point where the Castle Towers case went, or where they did this wrong. They just tacked it on and broke the lease. The other thing is the private well issue. And the question that came up yesterday was, how do you calculate based on a private well? We have a solution for that in the A1, which because water usage has to be reported to the DNR if you're pulling it out of an aquifer, and that's the numbers you can use to do a fair calculation for private wells. So we've solved, I believe, that issue. So those are a long laundry list of provisions that are about consumer protection, resident protection. Yesterday I had pulled together the parties and I said, can we do here to come to some agreement on this? And members of the committee, this is my best effort at coming up with something that I truly believe is fair and will help it so that you don't have to spend the rest of your lives in court fighting over the water meter issue. That is my intent here, is to help solve this problem. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I believe we have some testimony, a block of time for proponents and also for opposition as well, and that's fine. Okay, I can answer any questions right now.
Okay, thank you, Representative Gerlach. Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gerlach, I had someone in my office discussing this bill yesterday, and this is a provision on your amendment, your A1 amendment, that I kind of had some questions about. So I just want you to clarify it on the record. On line 14, where it says applying the prevailing municipal water rate, you're applying the closest municipality with that provides water to its residents, correct? Because there are areas where you will not have a municipality
in the same county or within a fairly close range. So
okay.
I'm just trying to get you to clarify on the record.
Can we do this when we have some of the folks come up who drafted that language specific like that? Maybe they can answer that. If not, we'll figure something out.
Well, fine. Mr. Gerlach, why don't we have them come up to the table now?
So we have for Mahoney, we have the license issue and the prevailing word. Those two things, and we'll get answers to those.
Okay, who would like to answer that question there that Representative Mahoney had?
Representative Linder, Representative Gerlach.
Would you identify yourself for the record, please?
Sorry, Mark Lambert, Representative Linder, Representative. The issue of the prevailing rate, the intent here is not to form shop, if you will. The intent is that communities that typically have well are located somewhere, and if that community is providing water and sewer, the intent is to use that water and sewer number from that community. I don't know that we specifically address the issue of being out in a township where there's nobody metering, but I don't know that anybody would oppose the concept of understanding that it's limited to the closest proximity. I don't think anybody's trying to form shop.
I just want it on the record in case there's a court case.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, my name is Mark Gruner. I'm with the Minnesota Manufactured Housing Association. To the question of licensed home sites, manufactured home parks are required to be licensed by the Minnesota Department of Health, so that any home site you have is on record. You're charged on your license fee based on number of home sites. So it's just, if you will, a way to establish how many home sites are involved here. So it's not an arbitrary number.
Okay, I think Representative Gerlach presented the bill pretty thoroughly, and these gentlemen are here, and as well as Representative Gerlach still at the table, so we have another question. Representative Clark.
Yeah, I think it's perhaps for this gentleman is
signing. Mark Lambert.
Lambert. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So on the amendment where it says you're going to apply the prevailing municipal water rate, and I think Representative Gerlach is saying that you're figuring out what's coming out of the aquifer. How do you measure or meter the sewer rate? That's part of the bill. Is that part of the bill?
Mr. Lambert, would you like to answer?
Representative Linder, Representative Clark. Typically, for obvious reasons, municipalities elect not to meter sewer. So the intent is that they typically meter the water and then apply either that same rate against what they estimate their sewer charges are, or they simply do a flat fee against the sewer usage that's there. So there isn't a sewer meter per se. The municipalities have either adopted one or two formulas. Either one is they extrapolate a sewer number that matches the water usage number that can be applied against the usage number, or they simply do it as a flat fee basis.
Well, Mr. Chair, in that case, you're not really measuring anything that the resident has any control over.
Representative Linder, Representative Clark, that is correct. Typically, they just have elected not to do that. I think perhaps, and I'm just guessing here, 80-90% of the communities, I think, just give a rate that's tied to the water usage, and there are a few that have just elected to do it as an individual charge to the home site. So those cases where they have done it as a flat fee to the home site, those are very distinguishable and can be kind of included as a pass-through charge. The intent of the amendment was where there is a sewer that's a flat charge to simply pass it through as a flat charge. Again, the bill as proposed here provides simply pass through where there are municipal charges. No add-ons, no capital costs, no additions.
Mr. Chair, so this is water going into a septic system, probably, in the case of a private well, private septic. Under this bill, the owner would be able to come up with a flat fee.
Members, try to use your mic. It's kind of hard to hear when you're not using it for the audience and for us. If you
are
could.
You talking to me? Oh, okay.
Anybody, I think a lot of us get out of the habit of doing that, and it's hard to hear.
You're correct. So in the case of a septic, private well and private septic,
there would just be a flat fee that could be calculated by the nearest municipality and put on there.
Representative Linder, Representative Clark, that's correct. The intent here is to simply follow what the municipality is doing in their formulas. The intent is just simply to pass through those numbers and not create new numbers. So, Representative Linder, I did have a few comments, if I may.
Okay, we have a couple of questions. Do you want to hold it till after the testimony, or?
Well, it's on this issue about the water.
Okay, Representative Dabney was first. And,
all right. Thank you. We may all be fishing in the same pond here, although it's the wrong pond to fish in. two questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still needing some clarification on this. The questions that Representative Clark was working at with the witness. Page 3, line 5, or starting line 4, if the water or sewer service is provided by means of a private well, a private sewer or septic system, the park owner may bill the residents at the rates permitted for utility charges under subdivision 3. I guess as I'm reading it, and the question I have then is, I'm living in a park, it's serviced by a septic system, but now I'm going to be charged sewer rates for a septic system. Am I right about that, sir?
Representative Linder, Representative, would you repeat that question for me?
Certainly. If the park has a septic system under this legislation, would the park owner then be allowed to charge me sewer rates for a septic system?
Representative Linder, Representative, yes, they would. And the following here is again to follow municipal rates. We should really clarify that there are probably, I guess I'm not good at permutations, but the types of communities you have out there today are those that have municipal water, municipal sewer. Those are easy, simple pass-through. You have well, municipal sewer. Those, I think, follow Representative Clark's question, where you already have a well there, but there's maybe a flat charge that's coming from the municipality for the sewer. Then I guess you have a group that would have private well, private septic. The group that you're asking questions on if the park elected to meter that water, the bill would also then permit them to charge for a sewer charge as well, and at the then posted municipal rates for that particular municipality. Keep in mind that this is one area that we have spent a fair amount of discussion on. There seems to be kind of a concept that there's a no cost for private water and there's a no cost for private septics. The intent here isn't to do anything but try to have a consistent statute. If you're billing for municipal water, should it make any difference that you're billing for a private well if the intent is to conserve water? Because certainly that water comes through and it's passed into, it's drawn out. The MPCA is tracking the water usage. Certainly additional usage loads in on the septic system. So this is certainly one that I won't tell you wasn't without some discussions, even among our own industry, as to how to do this. And it seems to me you have a couple of choices. You simply say this is one solution where you allow the community to bill for private water and private septic, even though they may not be now. But again, remember, they need to try to create a formula to roll it back somehow accordingly. I mean, we're not trying to get new money. We're simply trying to roll it back then by an MR that we've included in here in Representative Buck's amendment, roll the rent back, and allow for some conservation to start happening on the wells and on the septics. The alternative to that is to simply say, look, let's ignore that subset of private well, private septic, not allow any sort of billing, and just continue to allow the free use of that water, if you will. But that didn't seem to be consistent with the theme of conservation within this bill itself.
Mr. Chair, sir.
Representative Dabney.
Thank you. I'm not real bright about septic systems. We don't have many in South Minneapolis. but thank you, Representative Mahoney. But as I'm thinking through the scenarios, couldn't we have a scenario where a park has installed a septic system, included the infrastructure cost to that in their monthly rent to to the renters, paid off that infrastructure cost, and now would start billing a sewer fee even though people are not on a sewer line?
Representative Linder?
Mr. Lambert.
I think the answer to that is no, because I think that Representative Gerlach dealt with that in this last amendment, number two, whereby he's incorporated a formula that says that if you are on a private well, the rent reduction has to be calculated using that municipality's rate. So by using that calculation, they're going to be rolling back rents and giving a credit back. Now, certainly within the municipality's rates, there's probably some infrastructure number, but I think built into the municipality number then, when you reduce the rent by a similar amount, will then reduce any infrastructure factor, I think, in the rent.
Mr. Chairman, ask one quick question.
Representative Devin.
Thank you. I'm still slow on septic systems, so we're going to move off of them. Line two on that same page, the park or starting on line one, the park owner shall consider only the actual amount, and then down to line three, shall not consider. Consider seems to be a unusual choice of words, an imprecise choice of words here, and I'm wondering if, since I think Representative Gerlach indicated you may have some responsibility for the language here, if you could explain what consider means in this setting and your choice of that term.
Representative Linder, Representative, not necessarily a conscious choice in terms of saying that, that it's to be soft. The intent here is simply to be a pass-through. The intent here is simply to be a pass-through. I don't know that anybody's married to the word consider. I think I just heard...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Representative Danny. No, there's no thought there at all. It could easily say include or bill or something like that. If you have a recommendation, I don't think it makes a difference. But the intent, you know, we share the same intent.
Okay. We can work on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for your indulgence.
Okay. Representative Nelson, do you still have a question?
Yeah, my question has more to do with the water part side of it, not the discharge side of it. But the I guess I have a question. If somebody has a private well and they're billing at the same rate of municipalities charges for water, most municipalities, when they provide water, have to treat it, fluoridize it, all those things, and there's costs there. Now the park owner is going to be charging that rate and not be doing those services. I kind of see that, and even if you back it off for a year or whatever, I see that as a problem that now they've got an income source here, and I guess that's a concern I have. I understand there's a cost of maintaining a well, all those parts of it, but I guess that's the concern I have, that they'd be looking at this billing for water that we're pumping out of the ground and doing nothing to, where a municipality, they're charging you for the services that they provide of providing a safe and treated water.
Representative Linder, Representative Nelson, I believe. I don't think that that's the case. I think that with the MPCA's involvement in municipal water and also small water operators, there are very stringent requirements, and I think that we've all seen news reports over the years when a community has fallen outside of compliance with those. So there are clearly costs in keeping those well systems current. Now, I know that communities typically don't chlorinate, but I do know that they do filter, they are subject to regular testing. So I guess I would tend to disagree with that I think there are costs associated. But again, I guess I would remind you that the formula that Representative Gerlach came up with here has that rollback in there, that those costs that may already be in there are in a sense being rolled back already, so that I still think you're looking at perhaps a net savings to the residents if you factor in the consumption that or the conservation that may come of that.
Okay, I think Representative Gundler, to that point. And would you use your mic, please? I know it's awkward to talk to people.
I have a lot of farmers in my district, and they would gladly trade places with the people in town for cost of water and cost of sewage disposal.
What type?
Okay. All right, next on the list is Representative Mullery.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Gerlach. I know that you're a big saver of taxpayers' dollars, and I'm wondering where you're going with this, because they're operating and basically charging for something they get free, and okay, that's questioned, but then with concentrated septic systems, we've seen that ends up costing the state money in the long run. So why are they being allowed to get a profit on that, or Are you looking to someplace plugging in some part of that charge as a payment to our environmental funds or something?
No. Representative Gerlach, you think this should go to environment?
No. Chairman, Representative Mulley, no, but I'm going to question the premise of your question, which is that they will profit. Remember, there's a rent rollback as part of this. You don't just get to profit from it. Yes, that water is there in a private well, but you've reduced the rent. You've rolled that back, and so there's not the, that's the whole intent, is not to profit. So I don't see where they're profiting from anything.
Members, you know, this is going on quite a long time here for this discussion, and I think we're just kind of beginning to go back and forth. Representative Goodwin, your name's been on the list for a while, so we'll hear you, and then we're going to go to the opponents and where they'll have their proper time, and then if there's any time left, we'll continue on with the questions.
We went after my bill presentation. We sort of went right into questions. So I don't know. Maybe Mr. Bruner had some comments to make or others. We never really did that yet as well. So they can make some brief comments when the time comes.
I don't know that you'd have any more to say about it, but do you have
I
any?
I just want to cut anybody off.
Mr. Bruner, do you have anything to say?
No, I would just to follow up and say that you know we have worked over the interim since last session, and this is a new bill. We've spent time with the Attorney General's office. We've spent some time recently with the advocates, and incorporated in this bill and the delete all amendments, most all of, and I really emphasize most all of the suggestions that they have had, the rent rollback, the offset, the standards for meters that must be met. The issue of the private wells and how do you come up with an amount and that. I mean, so we have done our best to address their concerns and really make this, if you will, a revenue neutral issue for manufactured home park owners. No one has said to us, aha, we see there's somebody making money here in some way. This is not the intent. It's not here. We think it's good, it's fair, and addresses some real issues that that exist right now in terms of those people who would like to go forward or already are metering water in manufactured home parks.
Representative Lambert.
I take a few minutes. I think I can still keep it in the 15 minutes that we were allowed. I just wanted to introduce myself and to indicate that I am a community owner and that I had recently metered a community that I have in Lakeville. I did want to just point out for the record, though, that there are really three types of subsets of communities that you know you need to be aware of here. You've got those that aren't metering, aren't thinking about metering, continue to provide the water and sewer as part of their rent. They're not part of this discussion today. Also, you have those people that had new communities right from the get-go, have water metered right from the get-go, and they aren't part of the discussion today. Similarly, you also have residents that have moved into communities that are metering, signed up for metering right from the get-go, and they aren't part of the discussion today. The hard part of this discussion is, what do we do with those communities that aren't metering today that want to meter today? And that's really what this battle is about is, you know, did the community say free water forever and continue to raise rents to kind of cover that free water, or is there a mechanism with your help that we can implement here to allow communities that want to go from no metering to metering to do so without the fear of class action lawsuits? That's really what it's about, is that last subset. I'm one of those guys that kind of live in fear of a little bit of a class action. I don't think it is there for me anymore, but it's always possible. I suspended my metering after 2 years. But I did hope and want to share with you just a quick summary so that you could see that this is meaningful. They're passing around now, I see, a summary of our water consumption for 4 years. The first 2 years were not metered. The last 2 years have been metered. Our per-resident water meter equivalent went from $23.06 a month in 2000 to $14.55 in 2003. That's taking all of the water charges for a year, that's dividing it by 12, that's dividing it by the number of home sites, licensed and home site same, and coming up with the number of how much did the average resident in that community in that year use, or the average home site. We had a significant savings. 40% was saved in there. And not only was that meaningful, the very first month we implemented the water, we had one resident that had a $220 per month bill. And when we went to them, we found that that resident had a running toilet. And they had had that toilet running forever. And had we not had the meters, we would have had no way of knowing that they were using $220 out of a $260 a month lot rent that was going for just a running toilet that they weren't fixing. The other advantage that this gives to community owners, and the reason community owners want to go to this, is that it allows us to total up what the residents are using and take that against the amount of our bill, and it gives us a number that should equal. And if it doesn't equal, that means we have infrastructure problems, that were it not for the meters, we'd be passing right along to the residents as part of the cost. But as part of the meters, we're able to go in and find, hey, look, we're $500 off this month on our billing. Where's the $500? Is there a problem? Is there a leak? And then we can fix it. So from a conservation point, I just wanted to put a little testimony in that this is meaningful, and that in my case, when I implemented it, because there wasn't anything about rollbacks that Representative Gerlach was talking about, I did it as a reasonable rent increase. That's the language that's in the statute. That's why I think I'm safe from class actions, but you never know. But I did it as a reasonable rent increase. I waived a $20 rent increase in January 2001 and implemented this. If you look at this, you can see the residents got the benefit of the bargain. By 2003, my $20 rent increase that I waived was yielding instead a charge of $14.55. So I think there's value to doing this. I understand it's a very controversial issue. My only comments for you are that, you know, you need to be mindful that we're dealing with communities going forward here. The rent rollback applies to communities going forward. Communities that are metering should be able to continue to meter, and I think that's the intent of what Representative Gerlach have done here. But that we need to work on a mechanism for those that want to go from simply a free-for-all on water to some sort of conservation can do that, and that's what we're here for.
Okay, thank you. Representative Goodwin, did you just have a comment or a question?
I have a question, Mr. Chair.
Representative Goodwin.
I want to know if this would allow a park owner to charge for water and sewer even if the current contract for the homeowner in the park says it's included.
Representative Linder, the intent of this is if the rent increase is given that yes, it would, or the rent rollback, I'm sorry, is given that yes, a current owner that has a lease agreement that says that they will provide water and sewer could change their agreement to provide for this by giving the rent rollback.
I want to add something to that. Because this is a critical point that Representative Gooden raises. And that is, if a resident has that lease agreement, then that should hold. Well, statute allows for changes, for modifications to rules and leases. Statute allows for that, but it has to be reasonable. And it and statute defines what are unreasonable changes. So it's not that it's in, stone there. There are changes that can be made. And the reason that the Castle Towers case, that the courts ruled it down, or they ruled in favor of the residents, was because they violated that. What they did was it was an unreasonable way that they went about it. This bill makes it reasonable with the rent rollback and all those other protections. So the short answer to your question is yes, but it now is a reasonable rule change, is what this bill's about.
Mr. Chair, along the same line, when you say in your amendment here that the rent increase, one of the options is to waive the resident's next regularly scheduled rent increase, that language, unless there's some statutory amount or by inflation or something like that, makes me real uncomfortable because what defines a regularly scheduled rate increase, and what would prevent a park owner? And I'm asking these questions because I have the only city in the state that is a manufactured home park, and that's Hilltop. So I have a lot of residents affected by what happens
here. Well, I can ask a question simply, Mr. Chairman, the A1 amendment on line 12 deletes that section. So there is no longer the waive the residents' next regularly scheduled rent increase, etc. We deleted that. That no longer exists. Now, the only option, there is no option, the decision is to just have a rent reduction. So that should clarify that for you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Gerlach. It's in. Are you working on your DE1 amendment still?
Well, the DE, Mr. Chairman, Representative Goodwin, yes, the DE1 amendment, but then we also amended the DE1 with the
okay.
A1 amendment.
Okay, so that's off of there completely. Yes. Thank you.
But that is a good question. We had those discussions yesterday, and appreciate your input on that.
Okay, we're going to move right to the opponents of the bill. And first of all, we have Mr. Jim, is it Paste or Paist? We'll let you get up here and correct us on the pronunciation of your name.
Yes. Oh, actually, no. Thank you, Mr. Chair. You had it right the first time. It's Jim Paste. I'm the Executive Director of All Parks Alliance for Change, also known as APAC. We are a statewide organization of manufactured home park residents. Since 1980, APAC has been working to protect the rights of low-income park residents. And I just wanted to say right off the bat that I think Representative Goodwin really hits the heart of the issue here, and that is that, with all due respect to Representative Gerlach, this bill does really attack the heart of manufactured home park law and the integrity of the lease agreement. In its current form, House File 2227 is a bill that hurts low-income people, hurts families living on fixed incomes, seniors who can barely make ends meet. It hurts low-income manufactured homeowners in many ways. It violates the integrity of the lease agreement, and it violates the heart of manufactured home park law, which is very dear to us. It's a section of law that was created to govern the very unique circumstances of a park resident owning their home but renting their lot. This bill hurts low-income people because there aren't adequate consumer protections in place to prevent the frequent irregularities and mischief in billing that's occurred in many parks that have used water meters. Now, I know Representative Gerlach, and I know his intent of the bill is not to hurt low-income people, but as a consequence, it does. I applaud him for making some positive changes in the right direction, and I applaud the Park Owners Association also for making some concessions. But these changes don't address the two most fundamental issues at hand, and that is breaking the lease agreement and consumer protection. Over the past 4 years, APAC has received a large volume of complaints from residents from various mobile home parks where families are often egregiously overcharged for water usage. There are parks in Anoka County where people have been charged over $200 for 1 month of water usage. Parks in Dakota County where poor families have been charged $400 a month for 1 month water usage without any reasonable explanation for why the bills are so outrageously high. Parks in Maurer County, southern Minnesota, where residents have faced similar charges for water. Homeowners are then faced with the peril of paying the bill or being evicted from the park and losing their homes. This is a very serious issue. When residents challenge the amount of the bill, they have very few options for recourse. The most common explanation that we hear from management, from park management, when there is a challenge of an outrageous bill, is that it must be a clerical error. Unfortunately, some park owners have established a horrendous track record in billing in their attempts to operate like a regulated utility. A big problem is that until the appellate court ruling last January, the manufactured home park owners have been allowed to act like a regulated utility, but without proper consumer protection in place. And in many cases, unfortunately, there is no truth in billing. I'd like to bring some context into this discussion in recent history. This whole case came about 4 years ago when manufactured home residents of Anoka County and Castle Towers were approached by the park with water meters forcibly installed on them, an attempt to break the lease agreement and to start charging for water, even though water was clearly included in the lease agreement. In fact, to quote the Castle Towers lease, it said, quote, the park will provide the resident with sewer, water, normal garbage service at no extra charge. Residents of Castle Towers banded together and challenged this breach of their lease agreement in court. The district court ruled in favor of residents and ruled the action by the park owner to be a substantial modification of the lease agreement. So the park owners brought the case to the State Court of Appeals, and 18 months later, the appellate court upheld this very important ruling for residents and again ruled this to be a clear breach of the lease agreement.
Now, Representative Gerlach did refer to a number of court rulings, but we look to the Court of Appeals as the final decision on this, and we're quite satisfied with that. The Mobile Home Park residents prevailed, and the integrity of their lease agreement was protected by the Minnesota Court of Appeals. About 6 weeks later, the Park Owners Association decided to change the law as a direct reaction to the court ruling, found authors in the House and Senate to move the bill, and they have characterized the purpose of this bill as an issue of environmental conservation. Okay? Manufactured home park owners are a business. They're in business to make profit, and we understand that. But it's hard for us to believe that this bill is really about conservation and that Park Owners Association has somehow adopted a new mission statement to rival that of the Sierra Club. This bill is a reaction to an appellate court ruling that upheld the integrity of the lease agreement between a manufactured homeowner and the park owner. Is there any evidence of a drought or a water shortage in Minnesota? Is there any evidence to show that park residents use water in a reckless and irresponsible way? I urge all of you to consider the impact of this bill on low-income families who will be hurt by these charges and weigh that with the speculation of any significant conservation or environmental outcome. I would like to open it up for questions, and I thank you for your time.
Okay, we do have three people down for some questions, Representative Broad, then Wilkin, and Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Pace, for your testimony. So I just have a quick question regarding fairness. Representative Gerlach has talked about fairness and working towards trying to create a fair solution for both the park owners and the residents. And we're talking about fairness as a group, or the residents as a group, but I'm looking at the fairness within that group. How fair is it for a single person to pay the same rate as a family of five? If you don't meter the water, they're paying the same rate. And how fair is that within that group?
If I may, I think that we're never going to have a perfect system, okay? But it relates back to the integrity of the lease. And when two parties enter into a lease agreement and they sign it, and it says that water's included in the rent, that is a part of the overhead cost for operating a manufactured home park. And one thing to consider here, too, is that we hear about the expenses and the pass-through and park owners trying to recover their costs. We're not talking about an apartment building here where there's all kinds of overhead costs. You're talking about basically a bare strip of land with a manufactured home park with very few overhead costs. And water is one of those few costs that the resident gets in return for paying lot rent.
Just a quick follow-up then. In the situation where there was the toilet running and the $220 charge that wouldn't have been found, up until the point that they found that that situation in that one facility, everybody else was paying for that running water, and how fair is that?
I don't know if it is fair, but I guess the counter question to that would be, how fair is it to force an additional charge on parties when there's already been agreement made? And I think that in terms of a toilet running or a leak underground, I think that there are ways to remedy those leaks and those problems, and I think that parks have that ability to identify those leaks within their own infrastructure. Thank you.
Okay, next on the list is Representative Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Pace, is it your position that metering doesn't affect an individual's behavior? Because if I look back to when I was a renter, I had a couple different places that I rented, and I'll tell you, the one that paid electric was included during the summer when I was away at work. The AC was running the whole time, and when I was at one where I was paying the freight, it got turned off as I left, and it got turned on back when I came back. So, do you not think that metering affects behavior and goes right to the fairness argument that Representative Broad brought up?
Mr. Pace.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wouldn't argue that meter could have an effect on usage. I would suspect that it would be marginal, and I must take issue with the presumption that park residents aren't responsible in using water. There seems to be this suggestion out there that somehow people who live in mobile home parks aren't using water responsibly, and we have to take issue with that.
Mr. Chairman, I take issue with your taking issue. it's a natural human thing. When something's free, you're going to consume a lot more. It's not disparaging of mobile home park residents. It's whether you're in a high-end condo that pays for it through association dues or whatever situation you're in. I think it's ridiculous to assume that it doesn't affect behavior. But Representative Gerlach's offering a solution here where, as you take into consideration changes in rent, you can also take into offset it with a change in the way this is billed. That seems fair to me. That seems fair because every year landlords are going to reevaluate the rent and whether it covers the what they need to cover and whether they can get a rent increase or not, and they've got an offset in here. What's not fair about that?
Mr. Pace.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilkin, we're not opposed to the concept of metering, okay? But part of the problem here is that you have the park owners industry acting and operating as a regulated utility without the adequate and appropriate consumer protections in place. And so that's a big issue here. So in theory and in principle, your argument makes perfect sense. But in practice and implementation, we have a whole different story here. And what we're looking at is people that have been evicted from their homes and from the park because they're unable to pay outrageously high water bills without any correlation between the use of water and the amount of the bill. So I agree with your point, but it doesn't quite fit with the reality of this current situation.
Representative Wilkin.
One last question. If the park is on a municipal system and they're getting billed from the city, they should be able to. Shouldn't they be able to tie that back? If you got 20 homes in a community, that the sum of the 20 homes bills, the sub billing, is going to equal the one from the city. So you have some protection there.
Mr. Price.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilkin, I don't completely understand your question.
Let me rephrase it. You got one bill coming from the city. Mm-hmm. You've got 20 residents that are using the water that's being billed under that, and if they're sub-metered, you should be able to add up the 20 bills being given to the tenants, and it should be no more than the master bill coming from the city.
Mm-hmm.
Does that not provide some kind of protection for the consumer?
Representative Wilkin, again, it surely would in concept, but again, when it comes down to practice and implementation and the current track record of manufactured home parks that have opted to use the water metering system, there are many, many problems and flaws that don't quite fit with that neat scenario there.
Okay, next is Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm kind of confused as to your opposition because you've referred a couple times to cases where families, it sounds to me like, have been ridiculously overcharged for their water. And they ended up getting kicked out of their homes because of it. And you're looking for more consumer protection for cases like that, but I see part of the purpose of this bill is to exactly do that, so that a situation like that wouldn't be able to happen under this new set of government regulations, essentially. So I'm curious as to what more you're looking for in consumer protection.
Mr. Pace.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson. You raise a very good question, and again, as I mentioned earlier, I applaud Representative Gerlach and the association for making some of the changes that they have to address those issues, but it doesn't create the type of oversight and checks and balances that would be necessary and appropriate for the park owners to operate and bill as a regulated utility. And we are currently, if I may, mention that we've been working on alternative language with people from Legal Services Advocacy Project that would exactly address that issue. In fact, it came up in yesterday's meeting, and I felt we were pretty close to possibly getting Representative Gerlach to adopt that language.
Members, we've got about 8 minutes, and there's about three or four people and hands still being raised to question here. Let me just ask this, and we may continue on, but is there anyone in the audience that has come a long ways that would like to add a personal touch? Well, do you have a spokesman that maybe to come up? Okay, why don't you?
We have a number of people, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Thank you.
We're not going to have time to hear too many of them, but We'll hear as many as we have time. Why don't the lady that raised her hand come up and take a seat?
Let us say good afternoon to all of you.
Yeah, would you give
my name
for the record, please, sir?
William Covey. I live at Castle Towers, and I understand a lot of the problems that was just talked about because I live there. I am low-income family. I originally came from Vermont. The reason I came from Vermont, we had to sell our home because I ended up coming down with congested heart failure and a few other problems, and we couldn't live in Vermont with the cost of living. Since I've been to Minnesota, I'm very glad I made the decision because the doctors you have here are just out of this world. They're excellent. And I'm glad that I am here in the hospital. Recently, besides the heart disease, I've come down with diabetes, and now I have cancer. They attempted to take my bladder out, and they could not do it because I bled too much. But let me tell you why I'm really here today. I'm here today because when you talk about water and being charged for water, there's one thing that nobody has considered. When you use water, only about probably 30% of the water that you actually use. But we're charged 100% usage. What goes into the ground, we're still charged for. When they drain the hydrants, to flush the hydrants, we're still charged for that. And also, not only are we charged for that, but they also come around your trailer, they check for leaks, they check for anything that's using water, and you're given a certain time and a letter to fix it or be evicted. Now, my wife and I moved in Castle Towers for one particular reason. I knew that my life here wasn't going to be forever, which nobody's is, but I wanted a place that my wife and my child would be protected, where they wouldn't have to worry about the landlord saying, oh, I sold the building, you got to move. So I took what money we had, and we bought this trailer. We had to do a lot of fixing up. When I bought the trailer and agreed to move in Castle Towers, they gave me a lease. I abided by that lease. But they aren't abiding by that lease. Now they tell me my lease is going to be no good. We can throw out all these options. I spend an average of $600 a month to live at Castle Towers. That's paying the rent, the phone, and electricity, and not even fixing up the mobile home. That don't count into that. That leaves me $400 to live on a month to buy food and to pay for medical, which is not enough. My medical expenses alone, just for my heart and my medication, is over $1,400 a month. And
because we got to get everything in.
Okay, dear.
My name is Colleen Barrett. I live at Castle Towers Mobile Home Park. I felt I needed to come here and address this issue about making it legal for owners to break leases and charging for water and sewer. Many people who live in mobile home parks live there not because they want to, but because they have to. There are very low-income people and senior citizens who live on fixed incomes who live in mobile home parks. The outrageous amounts that are being charged for a family of three for $23.95 a month to a family of six who received a $1,000 water bill one month, to a family of three again receiving a $96 water meter bill a month, suggesting that that family use 736 gallons of water per day for a 30-day period. These outrageous amounts are putting hardships, financial hardships, on these low-income people, and they're having to make decisions. Decisions like how much food can they buy or what medications get bought that month, depending on what that bill is. These are not very pleasant decisions. For 3 years, we've challenged this and won at the appellate court. I feel that by you allowing park owners to break leases is telling everyone that it's okay, that it doesn't protect. You have no rights whatsoever under a lease agreement. Only the park owner will benefit from that. I was told by my park owner during these discussions, if it's pee, let it be. If it's brown, flush it down. That was his way of me conserving metering costs. What a demeaning thing to say. Unfortunately, though, low-income and seniors will have to make those decisions. Do I need to flush the toilet? Do I really need a shower today? How would you like to make those decisions? I am urging you, as a low-income family, not to pass this bill and protect the residents of these mobile home parks. Thank you.
Okay, members, we've got a slight problem here. We're kind of running out of time, and if you can stay a little over, we'd appreciate it. We have a gentleman that has come from out of state in order to for the overview of the Governor's Workforce Development Center, and if you would permit, I would like to let him come up and give his brief presentation, and then we'll go back to this bill. No, you don't want to do that? Okay, the majority rules around here, peace in the valley, according to Chair David, so we'll go ahead and continue with this. And would you give your name for the record, please?
My name is Linnea Birch, and I live in Austin, Minnesota. And I've lived in the park since 1992. I moved in under a lease that stated I would be provided with water, sewer, and garbage at no extra cost. And my parents lived there for 20-some years. My sister and brother-in-law lived there. Over 30 years, it never cost for water, sewer, and garbage. In 1998, we got new park owners from Iowa. Immediately, they installed water meters without our permission, without proper notice, without permits, without illegally, actually. The city knew about this. A year later, they come in and they let a licensed plumber, they did it without licensed plumbers too. A park maintenance man, in fact, installed some of them. They started telling us that we were going to have to pay for these water, sewer, and garbage. We started paying for it, and we started complaining, and they said, we're going to evict you then if you don't pay for them. You have to sign a new lease, and these are in it. Now, this owner from Iowa knew everything was being provided, changed my lease, and has tried to evict me. We've been in court for 4 years now. Finally, because of the appellate court ruling, we now have a judgment in January. But we also have new owners from last year that have continued to do the same thing, and we've also had two rent increases since then of $30 each, and it doesn't matter because we're still sitting in court. I want over 5 years since 1999, we have paid a total of $2,415 water, sewer, and garbage and rent increases. With the former park owner, it would have been $900. We paid $1,500 at least. That's a minimum of $25 for water, sewer, and garbage for 1 month. $1,500 in water, sewer, and garbage fees above what my lease says. This is outrageous. We have a man out in the park that reads his meter every month. He has read his meter since July and taken pictures of it. They are charging him $6. The park is getting a bulk rate. And according to the readings, they're reading it way high. He should be charged $1 a month for water, sewer, and for water and sewer. He's being charged a minimum $6. Now the new park owner said, doesn't matter. We're going to just, if the water meters have to come off or if they break or whatever, we're not going to put them back on now. And we're not going to charge you we're going to give you garbage cans. But now your rent is raised $20. $20, they're not, under this bill, they said that it would lower it that much. Am I right? Okay. but it's raised it.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Burr. Burr, for your testimony there. And
my name is Ron Gatet. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Minnesota Office of the Attorney General, the Residential and Small Business Utilities Division. And I'm here to offer conditional support for the bill as it's written now. I think that the mobile home park owners and their representatives and Representative Gerlach have gone a long way to address some of the concerns that we had when this initially came on the horizon last session. We think it's almost there in many ways, but we have some grave issues. As a threshold matter, I'd like to say that we didn't like the idea of changing the terms of a lease. The Attorney General's office cannot take lightly a state-sanctioned interference with contracts. If you look at these leases, they say in black and white, water and sewer included. The state is going to come in and allow that to be crossed out, and suddenly people are going to be charged for something that they weren't getting. They don't have the bargaining power that perhaps the owners have. The bill has been touted as a conservation bill, which appears to me to be disingenuous. In any case, my office has gone on record as being very much in favor of metering and submetering because of the personal accountability factor that introduces the fact that people who are metered, whose usage of utilities is metered, does result in lower usage, which is good. And so that kind of swings us to wanting to see something like this happen. But it has to be done right. We feel that the bill does offer some good protections for people who are going to be metered, aside from the fact that they had been getting the service for free. But we don't feel it goes far enough because it allows other utilities that are provided by the park, such as electricity, gas, propane, and garbage, to not have these same protections. We would have liked to see the bill include language such that the park owner could only consider the actual amount billed by a third party for all utility services, and we'd like to see that ultimately in the bill. The issue of private wells and private septic systems is problematic because there is no particular way to gauge what they cost. The language that's been provided in an A1 amendment to delete all number one is an attempt in that direction. But I've been trying to understand this. I think it's very noble to want to reduce the rent when you're starting to charge for water. But I don't see how it works. If the water from the private well was being provided at no charge and without being metered, how could we know what the previous year's metered usage would be, which is what this, I'm looking at lines 13 through 17. I don't understand how it happens here. I can only understand it if the well was suddenly being dug and there was metered usage from the municipal utility previously, then we'd have some way of gauging it. But unless there's 12 months of metered usage that isn't being charged for, then we would have the threshold values to know how much to reduce the rent by. That's a technical thing that I'm not quite understanding.
Okay, Mr. Gatek, I'm sorry, but we're going to have to cut you off there. We've got people jumping the ship, and they've got meetings, and we've got session coming up real soon. So,
Mr. Chair,
Representative Gerlach, would you like to renew your motion?
Mr. Chair.
House File 227. We're not going to take any more questions.
I'm not asking a question. I've got a point of order.
I didn't call on you, Representative Goodwin. Representative Gerwick.
I want to ask for a roll call vote, Mr. Chair.
Okay.
roll call vote has been asked for, and we'll have.
I'd like to make a motion too that we table the bill, and it sounds like there's the ability to maybe do a little more work on this bill and come up with a solution that people are more satisfied with than what we have right now. So I'd like to make a motion to table the bill and have the parties continue to work on this for a while.
Okay, Representative Goodwin has made a motion that we table the bill. Is this a roll call on the tabling?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that there's no debate required, and if there's a roll call, we can simply do a quick roll call for the tabling and then see what happens.
David Gerlach?
No.
Atkins?
No.
Broad? Clark?
Yes.
Dabney?
Yes.
Dorman? Goodwin?
Yes.
Gunther?
No.
Johnson? Coles?
No.
Lanning? Lindner?
No.
Mahoney?
Yes.
Mullery?
Yes.
Nelson?
Yes.
Osterman?
No.
Pugh?
No.
Rukavina? Sertich? Simpson?
No.
Stain?
No.
Sikora?
No.
Vandeveer?
No.
Walls?
No.
Wilkin?
No.
You already did. The other day.
Okay.
To the bill.
The count here is 14-6 in favor of hearing the Representative Gerlach renew his motion that this bill pass and go to the general orders.
Mr. Chairman, the motion to table failed, so now we're on the bench. I would renew my motion.
Okay. I'm not going to ask for any more discussion because we got to get out of here. So they've been asked for a roll call on the bill. Is that right, Representative Goodwin? Okay. We'll have one more roll call, and then we'll be dismissed.
Davids, Gerlach?
Yes.
Atkins?
No.
Broad?
Yes.
Clark?
No.
Dabney?
No.
Dorman? Goodwin?
No.
Gunther?
Yes.
Johnson? Coles?
Yes.
Lanning? Lindner?
Yes.
Mahoney? Mullery? Nelson?
Yes.
Osterman?
Yes.
Pugh?
Yes.
Rukavina?
Yes.
Sertich? Simpson?
Yes.
Stain?
Yes.
Sikora?
Yes.
Vandeveer?
Yes.
Walls?
Yes.
Wilkin?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I meant to say no. I was confused.
Yeah, I was confused.
13-5.
Okay, the roll call vote is 13-5, so the bill does pass. Thank you for everybody that exhibited patience in staying and hearing the testimony and the bill, and everybody that came to testify. You're dismissed.